Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we had a little glitch here with the entry music, but let's just jump into today's show. And as I promised last week, the topic is going to be liberal art in the age of Trump. A little bit of a departure from my typical show focus, usually on the economy, global, U.S., or the elections, but not really. We'll see how this topic is related. And when I talk about liberal art, I'm referring to mainstream, left-to-center, moderate films, public lectures, theater, etc. And I want to focus on three examples of that. But before I do, a few comments that need to be made also on the economy, things that have of note of the past week, and a topic related to the upcoming elections next week. I'd like people to step back and think about the big picture and what's really gone wrong here in the country, and indicators of that that you don't really hear them talking much about in the mainstream media, or certainly not in the Trump media, as they focus on their own opportunistic elections and their own issues. You know, we really ought to step back and ask ourselves, what the hell is going on in this country? Okay, so I want to talk about a little bit about that as well. America on the eve of the midterms, 2018, you might say, as well as some key economic events, tactical events of the past week, and then we'll get to our main topic, which is liberal art in the age of Trump. Okay, so really three topics here today. So let's jump into them a little bit here. Let's address some of these key economic events of the past week relatively quickly, but important of note. You know, in previous weeks of the show, we were talking about a bit about the stock markets and the second major correction that began to occur in October here. The first was back in February, and I called that a dead cat bounce. It was going to recover from it. And then we had a similar event occurring here in October. Markets of various kinds, U.S., global, under great stress and in retreat. Is there going to be another dead cat bounce, or is this the beginning of a fundamental downturn in financial asset markets? Well, we don't know that yet. But this past week, we saw a big recovery, didn't we, in the last few days here. Donald Trump said, oh, all of a sudden he wants to meet with China President Xi. And Trump asked his cabinet to draw up a trade resolution plan with China. In other words, sort of indicating all this crisis of trade with China, this trade war with China is I'm going to do something about it and end it. And then, whoa, what happened to stock markets? Just recover, right? 1,000 points up. What is this? No, come on. This is election tactical maneuvering by Trump. Trump is pulling out all the stops, trying to get his buddies elected here next Tuesday. And this is part of it. They're not going to resolve anything when they meet Xi and Trump again. This is to make it look like this problem, this growing concern with the trade war with China, which was affecting markets significantly, is going to be resolved by Trump here. So there won't be any trade war with China. You know, it was just a week or so ago that he was talking about imposing another $267 billion tariffs on top of the $250 billion tariffs already indicated on China. That would be tariffs on everything that China shifts to the U.S. which had American companies gasping. Why? Because figures I've seen, over half of the imports from China to the U.S. are from U.S. corporations doing business in China. Yeah, over half of it. So if they had to pay tariffs of 10 or 25%, well, that was going to whack their profits, their offshore profits. At the same time, that interest rates are rising and the dollar is rising, which is whacking their offshore profits as well. You see, there's a double whammy going on here. Rates and the dollar rising, impacting multinational corporations' offshore profits, repatriation potential. And then we're putting these tariffs on China. We're not really putting them anywhere else. And that's going to whack them in China, too. So, you know, that had an impact, negative impact on business and projection of corporate earnings, which had an effect on the stock market. So when Trump says, we're going to have a resolution of this problem with China, I'm going to meet with him, and this he leaks to the press that, I'm asking my cabinet to draw up a plan here, right? This is all for market consumption and for, therefore, political consumption. In other words, to eliminate this indication that the markets were really weakening this past month, and it might be the end of the Trump bump, therefore to make it look even more positive for the elections. You know, the markets and the elections are tied together here. Good markets, booming markets, he can go keep saying, look what I've done to all you rich folks with all your stocks. Okay, so that's what's really behind this. In my opinion, there's not going to be any quick resolution. And you'll see after the election, once again, it'll settle down into a longer-term dispute with China over trade. Okay, so it's an election year ploy. The other news that you might not have picked up on this past week was, remember TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, 13 countries in the Pacific that the U.S. Pulled out of in January of 2017. One of the first acts of Trump was to refuse to sign it, which was already dead anyway in Congress. And as I said, that does not mean that Trump is anti-free trade. He's a bilateral free trader, not a multilateral. This is the big shift in the elite's strategy on trade. You know, no more multilateral. We can squeeze more out of our foreign competitors on a one-by-one bilateral negotiation. And that's what Trump is really about. He's a bilateral free trader. Right? And we can see in the free trade deals already negotiated, no big changes. Some changes for corporations, protect the auto companies and so forth, but nothing really big and significant. You know, it's free trade is tied in with this elections again, looking tough, economic nationalism, Trump's main ploy here in the elections. That's why he's attacking the immigrants. You know, you got to have an enemy, right, if you're a nationalist. Drifting into a kind of American form of proto-fascism here. That's Trump. You got to have enemy within, an enemy without. You know, you can't have fascism without an enemy within, an enemy without. And of course, the enemy without and within, in some extent, are the immigrants. They're the enemy. And then, of course, you have the foreign corporate capitalist enemies, quote, they don't talk to them as enemies, but, you know, you go after them, free trade, the Chinese, I mean, here, right? They're the, quote, enemies. You got to have an enemy without and an enemy within. And then Trump is even toying with the idea of identifying protesters, you know, all of us exercising our First Amendment rights to demonstrate as, quote, the mob, right? We're the mob now because we dare to protest against him. Well, that's an enemy within. Okay, well, you know, I wrote a piece on this Trump as nationalist or proto-fascist here. Take a look at it on my blog, jackrasmus.com. And I'll be writing more about this as Trump drifts in that direction. A lot of similarities to early 1920s Weimar Germany beginning to appear here. Not saying that he's a fascist yet, but as a nationalist and, allowing all the neo-Nazis to come out of the woodwork and shoot people down, that's he's drifting in that direction. Okay, the jobs report came out today as well. Let me back up. I haven't finished with this TPP thing, right? The TPP thing, Trump refused to join, multilateral, initially. But now the other nations continued negotiations. The other nations that were involved originally in the TPP, under the sort of lead of Japan, which is, an economic satrapy of the United States since 1945 in many ways, the Japanese continued as the proxy for the U.S., and they continued negotiating the TPP, and now it's been concluded. The TPP is a done deal without the U.S. But now watch, as I predict, also a piece on my blog, I predict that Trump will negotiate bilaterally with each of these countries that are now signatories to the TPP and enter into the TPP from the back door on a one-by-one basis. He'll say they're bilateral deals, but they're really the same terms and conditions of TPP. Yeah. So we'll be entering the TPP over the next 2 years on a case-by-case basis, you see, through the back door. All right, so what about the jobs report? Well, the jobs report came out today, and we got a lot of new jobs created here once again, right? But where are they being created? Well, it's a lot of junk jobs, a lot of part-time temp kind of jobs on the one hand, and it's jobs at the very high end that most Americans don't qualify for. I'm talking about the tech jobs and the professional jobs and so forth, which leaves a lot of people out in the middle. We still have a 5% lower labor force participation rate, which, 5% of 165 million people in the labor force, you're talking about at least 5 to 7 million jobs of people out there who aren't being picked up on the unemployment rate. All you hear is this phony, ridiculous U3 unemployment rate, which means only full-time workers. Yeah, it doesn't pick up the part-time or the temps. And if you look at the U6 unemployment rate, it's 7.5% of 165 million, 7.5%, that means there's about 10 million who are unemployed. But even that is grossly underestimated when it talks about the missing labor force that aren't included in the unemployed. They got no jobs, but they're not included in the calculation. So there's at least 10 million people, which is really closer to 10% unemployment in this country, not the 3.7%. Now, is it 3.7%, the U3 unemployment rate? Something like that today. Well, it's under 4. Okay. Grossly underestimated. And a lot of these statistics, there's real problems with them coming out of the U.S. government. Real problems. Not just the unemployment estimate. Right? Not just that, but inflation. Inflation, according to the Federal Reserve, is like 1.6%. Does anyone believe that? No one believes that. Prices are going up everywhere, partly because of the trade situation, which is really a green light for businesses to raise prices, you see. That's the first thing that businesses do to really generate profits. Can they raise prices? And of course, now they're raising prices everywhere. And health insurance is going up everywhere. Student debt's going up everywhere. You go to a grocery store, stuff is going up everywhere. I talked about how, in one of my articles on my blog, how the government misrepresents inflation. inflation's really at least 3.5%. Even the CPI indicator does not pick it all up for reasons I explained. So we got problems with inflation. We got problems with unemployment. We got problems with this wage. Wages are rising fast. Government stat, you know, that comes out, what, 3%? They're saying wages are going up 3%. Well, wait a minute. There's a lot of different ways to calculate wages. And the way that 3% works is that that's an average, you see, for all wages and salaries. That's an average, which means the folks at the top, the 10%, managers, supervisors, salaries going up, professionals, tech industry, you know, professionals in the health industry, they're dragging that average up. At the median and below, it's a lot less. In some cases, it's negative. That's the average. It's also the number for only full-time employed. It's the average for full-time employed. What about the 50 million who aren't full-time employed and the 5 to 7 million who aren't even being picked up, aren't employed at all? Yeah, they're not talking about that wage. And then they're talking about it as a real wage adjusted for inflation. But as we've seen, the inflation rate's too low. So there's lots of ways they doctor these numbers, you see. And of course, they don't call, they don't include wages in the deferred sense. You know, pension payments are wages. Social Security are wages, deferred wages. You pay into those as you go while you're working, and then you get to draw it out. Well, that's not going up. That's going down in real terms. But they don't count those wages, you see. Nor do they count the fact that you got all this debt. Consumers are spending primarily on debt if they're in the bottom 80%. Debt is escalating in the U.S. Well, debt means interest rates higher. You're paying more now, which is a deduction from your future wages, you see. That's what credit and debt is. You're promising to give to the bankers or credit card companies some of your wages in the future. Well, shouldn't that be calculated into the effect on wages here? No, they don't do that, you see. They don't do that. They don't do deferred wages. They don't do stagnation. They improperly estimate inflation. Right? They don't count all the unemployed, and they don't tell you that the wage gains are really going to the top and not to the rest. Anyway, that's my explanation about these government reports. You know, there's some truth to it that the mainstream media is fake news. There's some truth to that. It's not all totally Trump exaggerating, you know, and it's not so much they're reporting stuff that's wrong. It's that that's just selectively reporting and legally only reporting certain statistics and not really explaining how the statistics they report are misrepresentations of reality. I mean, all you hear about this unemployment rate is this absolutely useless U3 unemployment rate of 3.8%. That's all you hear. They don't even talk about what the Labor Department reports as the U6 unemployment rate, which is more accurate at 7.5%. And even that is underestimation for reasons I said. All right, the other news here on the economic front, interest rates are accelerating once again, which means the dollar's going to go up and emerging markets are going to be, once again, they stabilized a little bit. Now they're going to be in stress once more. And as I've said, watch out for the 10-year bond rate as it hits 3.5%. That's the rate at which we start getting a credit crunch. And the Fed's going to definitely raise rates in December again, at least a quarter, and probably once more. But after that, the credit crunch, and then the rates are going to come down. Once again, as we slip into recession, as I predict, in late 2019, mainstream economists are saying 2020. Watch out, too, for junk bond debt, corporate debt. You know, the Federal Reserve has sown the seeds of the next crisis starting in 2010 for 7 years by keeping interest rates, subsidizing businesses with super low interest rates and bankers for 7 years. And that resulted in corporations piling on cheap debt, corporate debt, more and more debt. Watch out for high yield junk bond debt, which is at, you know, historic highs here. And now, with interest rates higher, to roll that debt over, if they are able to do so, is going to be very costly. And it's not just high yield junk corporate bond debt. It's the higher investment grade debt, what's called triple B debt, that's almost junk anyway. And it's leveraged loans, which is kind of like the analog for corporate bond debt, except it's corporate loan debt, leveraged loans. Even Janet Yellen, former chair of the Federal Reserve, has been writing editorials here in the business press warning about leveraged loan debt. Yeah, watch out for that next year and the year after. Okay, so those are some of the economic news of import that needs to be commented on, you know, backdoor to the TPP, the phony Trump notice announcement about cutting a deal on China with trade, the stock market's volatility here, the misleading jobs report and wage report, interest rates accelerating again, and junk debt. Okay. Let's move on to the second topic here about what does America really look like on the eve of the 2018 elections. Oh, once again, neither side is really talking about the real issues here. I mean, the Democrats' whole strategy is to attack Trump, slam Trump, and talk about Russia intervening in elections. That's their whole strategy. Well, you know, they don't really want to focus on the real issues anymore. As I've said, the problem is that corporate lobbyists own the Democratic Party. You know, they're the biggest, huge faction, over 100 of them, on the Democratic National Committee. And corporations don't want to talk about not paying decent wages or, you know, crisis in benefits and so forth. They don't want to talk about that. That's why the Democrats focus on identity issues for years now. That's a way of keeping everybody distracted. Well, and the Republicans, of course, don't want to do that either, since they're reaping the benefits of the policies here, hand over fist. All right, so America today, what are the real issues, right? We talked about misleading economic data. No one really trusts the media anymore. You know, on the one hand, you get misrepresented statistics or, you know, other issues that are questionable from the mainstream media. And then on the other hand, you get all the lies getting more and more blatant from Trump and the Republicans. You know, we need to rename these political parties, you know. It's not the Republicans anymore. It's the Trump-publicans. Trump-publicans is what we should call them, because Trump is purging all the moderate and driving out all the moderate Republicans, and he's remaking that party in his own image. The Trump-publicans, let's call them, right? And let's not call them the Democrats, right? I like to call them the lobbycrats, because, you know, it's dominated by, this leadership is dominated by the lobbyists. As we had a few weeks ago, we had on the show Nick Brenna, who used to be an operative within the Democratic Party, you know, revealed really how that party's been transformed here. You know, and this fight between them, between the Trump publicans and the lobbycrats, is kind of like a internecine spat, you know, pissing match between two wings of the corporate-led elite in this country. These parties are transforming, and as they transform, of course, they represent fewer and fewer of the rest of the real country out there. It's an internal fight in many ways between them on how to ensure that corporate America and the wealthy and the investors remain dominant in this country and globally for another decade. So, you know, one of the characteristics of America today on the eve of the elections is who do we believe, right? There's a lot of misrepresenting and outright lying going on both sides here. A lot of misleading economic data, right? People know, you know, in their gut that the economy is not booming. They know that. You know, they face the reality every day. Okay, so, you know, you can look at these doctored up economic data here. Not false, but misleading in that leaves a lot out of reality and doesn't talk about the real details, right? What about other indicators of societal decline in the U.S., right? Well, 60,000 deaths from drugs, most of them synthetic prescribed opioids, every year. 60,000 Americans die every year. You know, over 40,000 from opioids. And that's not people on the street dealing. You know, that's a lot of that's fentanyl and OxyContin and all that stuff. And what are they doing about that? 60,000. You know, that's the total, roughly, that were killed in, 8, 9 years of Vietnam War? You know, we, in just a month, well, less than a month. Well, okay, let's divide 60,000. You know, that's 5,000 a month. Half of that, 2,500 every 2 weeks, you know. 9/11, 2,500 people were killed. Well, hell, the drug companies are killing the same amount with every 2 weeks. And is anybody saying anything about that, really? Yeah, they sort of do a token here, token there about the drug companies, and because it is the drug companies that really, you know, a decade or so ago started pushing the fentanyl and the OxyContin and so forth on doctors and hospitals, who then just passed it on and got hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans addicted to this stuff. And if you get addicted to fentanyl, you can't stop. You know, there's no way that people can be cold turkey managed off of fentanyl. You just got to keep taking it or take something else, right? 60,000 deaths every year in this country from drugs. Oh, well, we're not through yet. Hold on. 45,000 suicides in this country every year. A 70% increase of teenage suicides in the most recent decade. 70%, a 30-year high in suicide rates. Okay, so 60,000 deaths from opioids, 45,000 from suicides. What about guns? 33,000 gun deaths every year. Did you know that there were 273 school shootings this past year? That's one every day almost. Is that getting reported in the media, in the press? Nope, doesn't get any coverage at all. 273 school shootings, 33,000 gun deaths, 45,000 suicides, 60,000 opioid drug deaths every year. And it's rising, escalating since 1999. Exponentially. Well, if that's not an indicator of some kind of social decline, I don't know what the hell is. We went to war in the Middle East. How many Americans have died in that? Not to mention how many of the other folks have died. innocent civilians. That gets a lot of coverage. But what about our wars at home here? Drug companies are killing us. People are committing suicides, killing themselves. Guns, the NRA is killing us. Nothing done. Lies and fears permeate the public life like never before, right? Trump, of course, has been fomenting a lot of that. The enemy, right? The immigrant, and now us, the mob, the protesters. Talk media, of course. Enemies everywhere. Neo-fascists coming out of the woodwork. Trump inviting them in many ways, right? You know, what's happened just this past week? You know, the bombs, pipe bombs being sent, and the murders in Pittsburgh. Yeah, it's just the latest of murders and going on, mass murders all the time. And who are these people? Well, they seem to come from, you know, the same source here. Mass killings, getting worse. What about voting? Did you know that we are in a 72-year low in terms of election participation? 72-year low. And, of course, the Republicans are doing all they can to suppress voters in Georgia, North Dakota, and elsewhere, making it even lower, right? I saw a survey recently that only 28% of millennials, in other words, people 30 years or younger, intend to vote. Only 28%. Talk about cynicism. Only 28%. A decline in democracy. The Financial Times last week, or no, a month ago, did a survey called the Freedom Score. And the U.S. Was on the eve of 2008, its score was 94. And that's dropped to 86. In other words, a decline in democracy. Two Americas. Well, two Americas began to emerge in the 90s. We saw it then. And you know, now there's feature stories coming out about Newt Gingrich. Have you read that? Yeah, Newt Gingrich, apparently a new biography of him. This is the guy who made started turning Republicans to the radical right, which ended up in the Tea Party and ended up in where we are now, the Trump Party, way back in the mid-1990s. And it's come out that, you know, Newt's whole approach was purposely to create a sense disenchantment with the political process, in order to make it look as if the political process was failing. He purposely set out to make Congress appear as if it was failing, and that would fuel his more ultra-right followings. Yeah, Newt started all this. Of course, he only started it. This has been going on and building ever since. But the Republicans in the right wing, from the very beginning, their whole idea was to lower the support for political institutions by making them look like they can't deliver. Well, they've done a good job on that, haven't they? Yeah. Cultural values and polarization has been going on here at least since 2000. You know, it was in 2000 election that it first came out that there are two Americas, you know, red America and blue America. Well, which is true, right? But there's other indicators of cultural value polarization and decline in fear permeating our art and everything, right? Well, look at it. What a fascination with zombies and dystopias, right? All this misogyny and the pop music. By the way, any of you out there ever gone to see how your kids dance in high school? Huh? Talk about preoccupation with sex and violence, right? high schoolers. Well, I'm not going to say on the air how they dance and what the whole idea of some of the dancing is, but, you know, if those of you who have watched it, you know what's going on, right? And that's a sign of decadence. Excuse me, I may sound a little bit older, but, you know, decadence, people get all, when there's crises and anxiety and so forth, people take it out in violence and in sex. And all this preoccupation with identity going on. A big distraction. Big distraction from real economic issues. You know, inequality, 35-year trend. Of course, Trump's tax cuts has accelerated that. And now watch out next year, big attack on Social Security, Medicare, education coming to pay for these $1 trillion a year deficits, especially if the recession sets in. McConnell's already said that's what he's going to do. You know, the Republican head in the Senate there, that's their next offensive. A crisis in retirement. People can no longer live on 401ks, and their savings rates have collapsed. Although the government here, another example, redefined the savings rate to raise it. You see, that's what government does when it doesn't like the data and it can't tweak it anymore because the reality prevents, you know, just the tweaking of it. They redefine it. You know, that's what Clinton did as he left office there with all the uninsured, healthcare uninsured. He redefined it and eliminated 5 million people. From it. That goes on all the time. Redefine the GDP numbers here to make it look like they're bigger than they actually are. Redefining the data on inflation, you know, using chained indexes to smooth it all out. Focusing on definitions of U3 unemployment rate. Not explaining the truth about wages. You know, these are all indicators of manipulation of the data, and retirement crisis is another one. Did you know the fastest growing segment of the labor force is folks over 65? Yeah, and even faster over 70. They got to go back to work because they can't make it. And then, of course, we have these constant wars going on now for 17 years, costing us already $7 trillion. Constant wars. Afghanistan never ends, right? Syria, Middle East, China, South Seas, islands, North Korea. And then finally, technology. You know, we're in an era of technology creating a kind of mesmerizing individualism. The sense of collective responsibility is being replaced with this super individualism. People preoccupied with themselves. And worries are beginning to appear that maybe all this screen time that kids are exposed to is having an effect on the brain. And even tech leaders now are beginning to worry about that, that the data is going to start coming out showing that we're warping the brains with too much screen time of the next generation of kids, right? Social media, negative consequences of social media are beginning now to appear. iPhone devices, screen devices. And as I've been writing here, watch out for artificial intelligence and the business model of Amazon and Uber, because these things are going to whack out jobs and earnings and wages even more than the trends that have been occurring up to now. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote about the Amazon and its effects on jobs coming, and the McKinsey report on artificial intelligence that projects 30% of all the jobs are going to be impacted seriously in terms of our or loss of jobs by AI. Artificial intelligence is going to eliminate most of the easy decision-making jobs. So the jobs of the future are going to be very, very high-skilled, highly educated jobs. And we're simply not preparing people for that. And all the folks who are working part-time temp service jobs now, those jobs won't even exist for them. What are we going to do 10 years from now when that's the case? Because AI is going to really start accelerating about 5 years from now and continue to accelerate. Okay, so, you know, this is the real America. Are they talking about these real issues? This is the real social decline going on in the country today. And we should be talking about these issues, preparing for the future. You know, I haven't even mentioned climate change, and clearly it's accelerating and getting warmer much faster. That's not even a topic so far in the discussion. You know? And, of course, you know, what this amounts to is the two parties, which are really one wing of one party now because of money, corporate party America with two wings called Trumpublicans and Lobbycrats. And that's why so many young people aren't even participating anymore, and fewer will. Okay, so let's turn to art. Liberal art in the age of Trump. I want to talk about this. And I call it liberal art because all these examples share a same common denominator. And I'll talk about that common denominator. What do I want to talk about? Okay, let's talk about... I saw a play not too long ago, about a month ago, a good labor play called Sweat. It was very popular on Broadway in New York and then making a tour. It's a stage play. It's not a musical. It's a true, you know, a good play. This play, you know, written by someone who wasn't a worker, but who went and interviewed people, working people in I think it was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And these were folks who had been, who had lost their jobs to offshoring. The company moved offshore. And the playwright, I forgot her name, did a good job in terms of reflecting the crisis, the personal crises in the lives of these people as their company began to, quote, downsize and move offshore, and they tried to stop it. You know, they had a union and everything. I mean, it's a reflection. The play is a reflection of the first decade of this century, crisis in offshoring jobs due to free trade and the tax system and everything, which encouraged companies to. Well, it started really with Reagan, has been accelerating ever since, the deindustrialization of America. So, you know, I commend the play in that sense. It was the lives of these people and set in the bar, you know, in places in the East, you know, outside the factories and so forth. You don't have to go far and you go have a drink, right? And people congregate in these bars, you know, as a way of release of difficult jobs that they have and the nasty jobs. You know, it wasn't a steel company, but it was clearly in you know, Pittsburgh manufacturing. It was manufacturing kind of employment. And the dialogue was very good. Yeah, there's some problems with the dialogue. You know, at one point, the playwright has as one of the characters saying that, well, you know, they're on strike, they're going to go file for unemployment benefits, right? Well, anybody who's been in the labor movement and work knows that you can't get unemployment benefits when you're on strike. You know, it just doesn't work that way. They've cleverly eliminated unemployment benefits. You're unemployed, but you can't collect unemployment when you're on strike. And then there was another comment about one of the characters who was the bartender who used to be used to work in the plant, got injured in the plant, and mentions that he probably should have sued the company for his injury. Well, once again, anybody who comes from, you know, real working working class origins knows that you can't sue the company for an injury on the job. That's what workers' compensation is all about, you know, to prevent you from suing. And, you know, that goes back to the progressive movement back a century ago. So, you know, those intellectual misrepresentations of the real world, you know, but they're minor. The real decay of the lives of these people is very vividly displayed, and the dialogue is you know, legitimate. It's accurate. They sound like real working class folks, and it's interesting how they fight against this attempt to steal their jobs at first, and you know, they go through one tactic to another tactic, and then when it's clear that they're losing and they can't stop the company from moving, what happens is that they start turning on each other, right? And they descend into drugs and into you know, despair of various kinds, even violence between themselves, you know. And this is very true. This is very accurate. So the play is accurate, but the play has this great fault of liberal art in the age of Trump. And what is that? It's, what do you do about it? Which is the number one question. You know, what are we going to do about it? Well, you know, the answer of the playwright to the crisis of offshoring and job loss was, we got to take care of each other. At the very end of the play, you know, they realize they've been attacking each other and destroying each other, and they say, we got to take care of each other. Well, sure, you got to take care of each other, but that's no answer. In other words, everybody, you know, sort of help each other out. Well, they can't help each other out because they're all destitute. How are they going to take care of each other if they're all so destitute, on drugs and homeless and so forth? No, it's got to be a political solution to that. And that's where liberal art stop short, you see, in the age of Trump. You know, if they talked about, if the conclusion was, you know, we have to do something more radical organizationally or politically organizationally, you know, like a break from the two wings of the corporate party, it probably wouldn't have gotten staged or financed. So liberalism stopped short of proposing a real solution. It falls back on, you know, let's just try to elect somebody else. Or in this case, not even that. You know, let's take care of each other. What the hell does that mean? Huh? Okay, so the same thing comes up. Celebrity lectures, which is a kind of art form. I saw a second example here. A lecture by Robert Reich, you know, Robert Reich, former Labor Department Secretary under Clinton here. Now he's a big academic at UC Berkeley. And I watched a presentation, public presentation he gave on civility in America, the loss of civility in America. He's very entertaining, you know, self-deprecating very entertaining, and in the course of the entertainment, he, you know, mentioned his connections, you know, in this election, 2016, last election, he was called in to give his opinion and advice to the Democratic Party leadership and the Republican Party leadership, so he's well-connected, you see. And he talked about the decline in civility, Trump, of course, driving all that, the Trumpublicans and their media. And, you know, he admits how this is splitting families how it's getting harder and harder to talk rationally because more of the discourse is irrational on purpose. You know, irrationality keeps people away from the reality. But Reich's solution to this was, at the end of his lecture, you know, if you're having these fights internally with, you know, your neighbors and other family members, you know, we got to restore civility. How do we restore civility? Well, you know, if Uncle Bob as he put it, your Uncle Bob, you know, he supports Trump and he's a right wing and he's radical and so forth. You just got to go talk to Uncle Bob, right? One-on-one, in other words. Keep talking rationally to the irrational. Yeah, that's going to work? You really think so? All right? The way to talk to people who are irrational, don't want the facts, are ideologically extreme, driven, emotional. You're going to talk facts to them? No, they don't want to listen to that. You're not going to change them that way. You're not going to change them at all, by the way. So, you know, let's be rational and talk to Uncle Bob is the solution to the current crisis. All right, let me move quickly on to the last example here. And that is Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 11/9. I'll be writing a review of that. A very good documentary, by the way. I think the best that Moore has done, and people should really see it. If you haven't, it's worth it despite its liberal ending and conclusion. Moore is the least. You can see Moore's trajectory going on here recently as he's moving more and more to a criticism of the Democratic Party itself. He's kind of at the edge of the cliff. You know, he hasn't jumped off yet. But it's a devastating film critique of the Democrats. It's also a critique of the politics of what went and is going on in his hometown of Flint, Michigan. You know, that's where that the water is poisoning people, kids and so forth, right? And you may not have known it, but he gives a great explanation of that crisis. And it's totally a man-made crisis driven by greed and Republican decision-making, including its governor. And what is that? Well, you know, Flint used to get fresh water from Lake Michigan, not Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, I think, maybe. Used to get fresh water. But then the politicians decided, they were going to instead provide water from the Flint River there. And that was polluted. So they were getting good water, and then they started giving them bad water. And then even GM, the GM plant there, complained that the bad water was corroding the metal on its cars and so forth, and they gave GM return to the clear water, but not the people. Yeah. I mean, it's going on and on, and then there was this great passage where Obama comes one time there, and he talks about a solution which really kept the problem going. Yeah, it was real criticism of Obama, you see, and that's very interesting. And then criticism of the Democratic Party in other ways, too, that's worth noting here in the film, right? Pelosi is quoted as saying, "We are all capitalists," right? And Steny Hoyer is revealed for where he's really coming from. The Flint water scam and the attack on Democratic Socialist candidates, Ocasio and others inside the Democratic Party, right? All these are revealed in this film, and you would think, well, gee, you know, let's make a break. There's no solution here. But he doesn't do that. See, he stops, right? There are some good parts in the film as well. And some of them, include revealing West Virginia teachers, the solidarity, and the Parkland students, and some fiery working class candidates in West Virginia in polls, and a lot of other examples. the fight for 15 and so forth is not really there. Black Lives is not really there. And he takes on Trump. So there's really three parts in this film. One, the critique of the Democratic Party. Two, a revelation of what's really going on in Flint. And then finally, an attack on Trump. And very clearly, he shows Trump's drift to the right going on here. And John Boehner, former chair in the House, Republican Party, quotes, "This is no Republican Party," is what he says. The attacks on the press that are going on, the fake news, right? How 52% of Republicans are willing to suspend the 2020 election if it means that Trump may not win it. 52% of Republicans want to suspend the election? Right? Trump talks about 16 years he would like to serve, which is a violation of the Constitution, of course, right? So there's 150 million gun owners are owned. 150 million guns are owned by less than 10% of the populace. These are some, you know, really extreme indictments of Trump and the Trump publicans and what's going on and what they really believe and where they're going. So it's a great documentary. People should go see it. Parallels with Nazism, right? But what's the solution? Once again, liberal art, the age of Trump, stops at that edge of that cliff. Of course, the big contradiction in this film is that, you know, it suggests so strongly that, you know, you can't stop. The solution is not to go back to the Democratic Party because they have no solution there. We may see this after next Tuesday, and by 2020, if the Democrats cannot deliver, if they cannot take the House, if they cannot stop Trump, it will be very clear that they're dead in the water. They are no solution any longer. And that's the most major indictment, I think, for a third party, an argument for a third party, because the Democrats can no longer succeed. Well, we'll see whether that happens. And, you know, Moore and the theater, stage play, Sweat, and Robert Wright's lectures all share the same common denominator, that is, they critique the system, but they don't properly admit that there is no solution with either party, either wing of the corporate party of America. Well, that's my analysis. That's the common denominator of liberal art in the age of Trump. You see, that's liberal art. It stops there. Well, probably because none of it would get produced if it went any further, you see. So at least they get something out. They get the critique out. And I'm sure that's what Moore's talking about. But Moore, if he's going to continue to go forward, has to confront that particular issue. The organizational question is the question of today. It is the question of the present. If we don't solve that issue, nothing else will get solved. We will continue to have suicides and mass murders and drug over epidemics and all the rest. Income inequality, stagnating wages, and so forth. Okay, that's my take on the elections. We'll see what happens. Now walk the streets, a screaming now.